I'm Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check.
Reality Check with Jeannie Allen is produced by National Review and is one of more than a dozen podcasts offered on the National Review online website. If you'd like a free subscription to the podcast so that you never miss a program, simply sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. And now, here's Jeannie Allen.
Hi, and welcome to another version of Reality Check. I'm so excited that you are with me today and listening wherever you are. My guest is John Hage. John Hage is the CEO and founder of Charter Schools USA. It's the fastest growing charter school company, serving 75,000 students in 84 schools across seven states, which is just amazing. But it's not just a charter school company. And I think, as John will tell you, they have been working in and around education and helping drive the innovations that many, many schools of all stripes and all sectors have been picking up on for some time. But prior to starting Charter Schools USA in 1997, which just makes him such an incredibly diverse guy, he was a Green Beret, U.S. Special Forces Green Beret. John holds degrees from the University of Colorado and Georgetown. And he was highlighted by the Florida Trend magazine as Floridian of the Year. Lots and lots of people from across the country, governors and members of Congress and press, go to him always because he is in the business of helping transform education for kids. John, thanks so much for being with me today.
Glad to be with you, Jeannie.
This is an exciting time for education in so many ways. While there are so many challenges, there are also just unprecedented solutions out there. And you're at the forefront of leading a lot of them. Just tell me a little bit and tell us a little bit about what makes you tick and why you wake up every day.
Well, thank you. And it's an honor to do this with you, Jeannie. And you know how much we believe in CER and the mission of the Center for Education Reform and the work you've done. So thank you. You know, I think what drives us and what drives this team is the idea that education is probably the only place in today's society where you can still have a bipartisan effect of involvement with the very lives that dictate our future in this country. And though it's sometimes seen as a long-term investment, we believe that that long-term investment around students and parental involvement and verifiable, accountable results actually is the only place you're going to get the long-term benefit of having a nation that's competitive and a nation that is prosperous, a nation that is more safe, and a place where we want to see our future generation and our students and our kids grow up and live in. So we're inspired by our mission to put students first in everything we do. We're committed to that with nearly 10,000 educators and staff and support across the country now. In our, I think we're at actually 87 schools, and the work we're doing, it's just it's transformative, not just for the students but for the communities, and also the the effect on so many other schools and school districts and even states that now have to do and want to do things differently because of the work we do.
You know, so many people will say things like, look, it's a charter school, so that's great, but what about the rest of education? Is that a misnomer, right? In other words, why charters? Why now? Why all these schools? Why did this have to come to this, if you will?
Right. So, you know, we don't really consider ourselves, even though our name says Charter School USA, about charters as much as we're about quality public options. And we focused on those over the last 20 years to the benefit of many other schools that are not our schools. I often talk about the school across the street from one of our very first schools here in South Florida, where the school was a perennial D, maybe C once in a while on its state testing, not outstanding in any way. But we opened a school across the street, and at first it was seen as a negative competitive effect in that it might actually try to, you know, take money and kids from that school for our school. And what happened ultimately was exactly the opposite. That school reformed and changed because they didn't want to look less. They didn't want to see their students receiving anything less. You know, people all have competitive nature inside. And it was a positive competitive environment. We shared ideas with them, and together we now have two A schools, a traditional public school and a charter school. And I think that effect has happened much more than the blob, as you've put it, wants to say. There's oftentimes conversations that are confidential with a school district or a superintendent, where the superintendent says, if it wasn't for the work you were doing or other charters or high quality options were there for, we couldn't have forced others, and especially teacher negotiations around maybe union contracts or things, to do things more innovatively or to create a new option. And it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have had that change. We wouldn't have made that difference for other kids. So there's definitely a much larger ripple effect on the work we're doing.
Well, that's right. And if you think about Florida alone, and I know that you're in seven states now, and of course nationally you're sought after and talked to lots of people. But in Florida alone, I mean, student achievement has gone up in every arena, particularly among low-income kids and minorities, because of that competitive effect, right?
That's right. And the USDOE actually keeps about, I think it's around 156 different categories that they look at for quality. And so it's very deep, very expansive. And of about 150 of those 156, we actually outperformed the state, yet we served more kids of color, more kids of poverty than the state. And we are, continue to try to serve those parents primarily who don't have options. But, you know, they come in all types and locations and backgrounds. Families, really don't have that many options. But education reform has created this option table, and I think it's understated how much of a benefit that's performed on the overall educational landscape, just like it did in higher education for so long. Nobody questions the fact that you have private and public and nonprofit and for-profit in higher education, but somehow in K-12 we continue to think of this as being exclusive and not, shouldn't benefit from the same forces that have made higher education the envy of the world.
Well, and just the freedom that entrepreneurial mindset has created. You know, I remember heading over to one of your schools, they had not quite opened yet, in North Carolina, and walking in and seeing the principal, and the buzz at preparations for the school, which all of the employees, from teachers down to the front office people, were involved in. And I said, she told me she had come out of traditional public education, and I asked her why she was there. And she said, just the flexibility that I have now and the fact that I can tailor the work happening in the school to the needs of kids is extraordinary. And those words, that's what we all seek when in any job, right? That's what we want. Employee satisfaction is based on having agency. And I think that's overlooked.
Yes, and I don't think, it's exclusive in any way to education. In fact, I think we've been a little slow in K-12. To coming to what the rest of the world has to deal with all the time, which is a customer service approach, an approach of understanding your framework but having an empowered workforce, leading by example by creating a culture of excellence and attracting and retaining high-quality employees. Education has a bigger strain on it than almost any other sector, with the quality of employees out there available, given that teachers are in short supply, and especially great teachers, because there is an economy with a very low unemployment rate. And so we have to challenge the traditions around this idea that a teacher, for example, is absolutely indispensable to us. And so we cherish them and we focus on them, and leadership is absolutely critical. So focusing on them actually helps us focus on student achievement, because these teachers are the critical linchpin for success for us. And I think, no one's perfect at this, but we're constantly in a place where we are looking to improve, reflect, and redefine ourselves quickly in a marketplace that is very competitive for talent.
Is there a secret sauce that is at play?
Well, one of the things is just being more agile. I mean, traditional systems take years to actually make changes. Contracts are year by year. Oftentimes, political environments change based on the superintendency. And, it's not really, meant to criticize, but the reality is that the traditional model of education in this country still is based upon some of the, you know, the elected school board members that most people don't even know who they are, and the turnout's below 10% on average for those elections, and oftentimes, and then superintendents who stay average of 2 to 3 years on at most, and so you don't have that kind of consistent long-term planning and vision that can take place, quite frankly, in a public-private partnership like you have in these charter models. So, you know, we are using that agility to our advantage by basically making decisions quicker, making decisions that are best for students and parents and teachers quicker, and that really does help us. The other thing is just having a strategic mindset, having one that's not based off of the latest, you know, sort of, you know, political whim or sort of, you know, flavor of the day, just being in a position where we're focused on the research. Education is less and less of an art and more of a science, as it should be, because the research is and the data is just indispensable in our decision making. And being able to focus on that rather than things that tend to be temporary has allowed us to drive long-term strategic advantage.
Right. So you ask, does it work? And then you're willing to move on if it doesn't, or you're willing to devote more time into it and more resources if it does, whereas the corollary is happening in most traditional schools where they bought something, they bought the program, so they're just going to use the program because, like, they bought it, right?
That's right. And they also have an incentive to use what they have and not use it judiciously. So the financial incentives are different as well. For example, our incentive is to actually get results and do that within a tighter budget. Most charter schools get less money, so we're having to do more for less, and I know that term has been used, but it's actually incredibly accurate to the way that we actually operate. So when you constrain someone to do more with less because your charter requires you to get better results, or why have a charter school, and you have to do it with less resources, unfortunately, oftentimes, this puts us in a position where we have to be more innovative, more creative, and to use those resources more judiciously. Oftentimes, the school system actually has to use the resources they have, or they don't get the same amount the next year. Same with state. And so our model is based on a different set of incentives. It's based on a different timeline, and it's actually based on a different strategic priority.
What can you tell us, what can we tell parents out there? I mean, we are speaking in September of 2018. Most kids just went back to school a couple of weeks ago. I know Florida starts early. And, you know, they're still bright-eyed, and parents are excited about the new year, and kids are making friends, and the notebooks are still clean, and the rooms are still clean. And yet, we always see this, like, a couple of weeks into the year, or a couple of months into the year, they'll start be like, Johnny can't read, or there's an issue, or I didn't know that that was what I expected. And so we're always about parent power, but what do we tell parents that they should be doing now so that the year can go smoothly and productively for their kids?
Well, first, if they're a parent who's listening to this, they're a parent who cares and they're engaged, and that really, really matters. So, you know, the world of school choice depends on parental involvement. It depends on parents being informed, education-minded thinkers themselves. They have to come in with this idea that they have a role, and it's a very important role. And I think the involvement of parents in the school choice world has inspired the rest of the K-12 world to do more about thinking about how parents are involved versus how you kind of keep them out of school. So I would encourage the parents to be vocal, to be a part of this, the decision making. I would encourage them, whether they're in a charter or a school, scholarship school or online school or traditional public school or even magnet school, to be involved. Have your voice heard. Make sure you show up. Ask questions. Number two is, you know, be involved in actually the kind of things that parents can and should be involved in. Make sure that the teachers are engaged the way that their kids are learning. You know, when we all grew up, we always talk about how if I got in trouble at school and I came home, I got double trouble at home. And we do today have this involved process where sometimes that's become, you know, unfortunately the opposite, where we need to support our teachers, because if they're supported, then They're not going to be questioned. They're going to be supported. And certainly there are times to hold account to a teacher not performing. But oftentimes we have so many good teachers that are ready to leave or do leave the system because they don't feel supported by parents. And so I really ask the parents that have great teachers to let them know that. Bring them a little something to let them know. Show up at a board meeting and shout out their case versus just the one teacher and 1,000 that, you know, deserves to be held to account. There's so many good teachers that we just don't get enough time to shout out.
Yeah, that's so true. So I'm sure that those issues were at the heart of why you thought about creating the law that now enables hundreds of schools to be open in Florida. So, John, let's go back to history, because you were you were a policy wonk for a while after having your great education, after being part of the armed services, and thank you for that. And then you were in Florida, and what, you just decided to, like, write a charter school law?
So it's, you know, I don't really get to take that credit. I worked for a tremendous policy wonk thinker who became governor, Jeb Bush, and Jeb was an inspiration for me. I left policy world in D.C. to come work for him. Because I, he had a vision for charters in the state of Florida and beyond. There were only a few states that had charter laws in the books back in 1995, but what he tasked me to do as his research director was to think through how it could be done in Florida, where it was much broader than just school choice, to look at accountability, to look at what is the right amount of testing? What is not? What is the way that parents can actually be involved? And did certification mean quality and teacher and design and development? And what did professional development need to look like in the next century? And so when we were looking at that, it really, for me, was an inspirational time to be a part of the writing of the ultimate law that got passed. So I became inspired by it so much so that, and I've always been, and I think you as well, Jeannie, I've never felt that our role, my role, your role, and others who've been involved in policy in the past or even today, that without implementing that policy, a lot of great laws have been written and never implemented well. So to me, the real work is how do you roll up your sleeves and put into practice what was a law and see how well it works. And I will tell you, the law has been tweaked a bunch of times, mostly for the better here in Florida, sometimes for not as well. And it has made the charter community a stronger, more resilient marketplace. We put in, for example, a really creative idea that if you're a high-performing charter school year over year, academically and financially, why shouldn't you be given longer-term charter contracts so that you can, you know, go into the market and get cheaper funding so you can finance out higher quality resources for your school, whether that's technology or a gymnasium or a science wing. And so this has changed a lot of the quality aspects of a charter. Not all charter schools are great, but some of the best charter schools were the ones that started with not a lot of resource, really did a lot with a little, and they've earned the opportunity to get longer charter contracts and better financing and funding from the state so that they can actually expand and become long-term quality options for the community. So I'm really proud about those kinds of things that we did. We allowed military students, the kids of active duty parents, to have a preference in the enrollment. We actually have charter schools for communities like municipalities. So we now have city governments that we operate schools for, where that city invests in developing and designing a school for their residents, because, you know, they have as much of a impact and a stake in the quality of their community as the school district does. And so there are lots of different ways to make and go beyond just the traditional aspect of a charter school, but to actually embed long-term, high-quality partners, universities as well, into the model.
Well, and you're talking about rewarding performance, which is extraordinary, and that's what, you know, this quote-unquote experiment, once upon a time, not an experiment anymore, was intended to show, is that the things that we should be doing in around education are what we should be extending everywhere. And so we started that with charters, and there are some places that pick it up, not all. And yet, despite the success, and despite the fact there are, you know, more than 7,500 charters around the country, Despite the fact that these schools have actually demonstrated their ability to help all schools make progress and empower parents and increase the way or improve the way we educate kids, there's still so much opposition. And so just recently, you all had a setback. There was an initiative on the ballot that would have allowed a few things to happen for chartering in the state. One is not to have it entirely dependent just on school districts, because, you know, that's like going to, what did my friend Lisa Keegan once say, former Arizona superintendent who's been on the show? It's kind of like going to your husband and asking for a divorce and saying, I want the couch, I want the dog, I want the kids, and then you expect to be nice, right? So having someone who wants to start a new school going to the school district and saying, give me the keys, give me the money and everything else, not so good. So that initiative would have done that. And the judges like pulled it off and said the voters shouldn't be able to vote on whether they want more ability to partner with different kinds of institutions to start schools. I don't get that.
Yeah, it's a disappointment. It's called Amendment 8. And, you know, every 20 years in Florida, there's an appointed constitutional revision committee, and it's a cross-section, bipartisan thought leaders throughout the state. And one of the several amendments that they put on for the November ballot would have allowed for the things you're talking about, along with some other things. And of course, what happens is the League of Women Voters and some of the others who just tend to have a gut reaction that's negative always to anything that's school choice related or reform related. They challenged this in court on a narrow vote of 4-3. The state Supreme Court did not allow it to go on the ballot, primarily because they said there were too many items convoluted under one question and that it wasn't clear at the top of the question if it was about charters versus other issues like limits on school board terms, et cetera. That said, I don't think it's an indication against the concept of choice. The overwhelming majority of people in all states at this point, especially in states where you've had quality charters and people can see it, are supportive of charters and choice and school choice. Florida has polls on this all the time. Folks here do, and we get strong results. Unfortunately, though, this is why an executive governor branch appointment election is so important, because they also appoint these state supreme justices in Florida, and that's the result of having governors in the past that have appointed folks that just aren't supportive of the idea that the parent is the ultimate decider. That is the ultimate level of local decision making, right? People always talk about school districts and how they're local decision making. And I challenge them. I say, really? I said, school districts are necessary and they're part of the American fabric of education. But the ultimate decision maker is a parent and a taxpayer. And they are contributing to their child's education through their taxes. And they're the ultimate decision maker for their child. So it's an unfortunate setback. That said, Florida will continue to prosper, and there'll be other, I'm sure, initiatives in the future that might meet the technical requirements. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, it's a great, great sentiment, really. I mean, local control is the parents. I know that a lot of people listening think about local control being the fact you have a school board, but that actually isn't any control. They have really nothing to do, very little to do with how funds are spent overall. It's really much more at the state and even driven by the smaller but still very significant dollars spent by the federal government. And so school boards can make decisions about zoning or where kids go to school, they can, about buildings, and they can authorize purchases. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, they can't do what a parent does, which is say, this school is better for my child, or this school is not working for my child, or I want something completely different. It's really critical that we all understand that. So part of making people and helping people to understand what really is at play, because, you know, education still gets such short shrift in the media these days. You and I and about 400 other people are going to be celebrating and deliberating and convening about where do we go next. CER celebrates its 25th anniversary. in about a month and a half. It'll be October 26th in Miami. And John, I'm so grateful to you. You are one of our 25th anniversary Pioneer awardees because of what you've done, because of how you've helped shape this, because you're so inclusive, and because it's critical that not just at a conference and an event in Miami, but the people nationwide understand the thousands of people who have put their heart and soul into creating a movement so that we can change the way we think about the issues and drive success so that all of our kids, all of our adults, all Americans, in fact, can have access to a great life. So I think we're going to have some fun, and I would just love you to kind of offer some thoughts about how we can use these important days and times and knowledge to drive real information.
Well, first of all, Jeannie, I just, you know, can't say enough about how the Center for Education Reform and you have been the godmother of this revolution, and I consider a revolution, not an evolution. I feel that the aspects of this movement are akin to the kinds of movements that have in the past in this country allowed for equity and equality and options and opportunity. And so just thank you for being a leader, and I'm proud to be affiliated with CER and to support this 25th anniversary. I will also say that, you know, we should celebrate. People think, oh, we don't have anything to celebrate. That's just not true. It's amazing how far and how many students and how many people have affected. I get students now who actually come back, graduated from our high schools, go to college, come back and work for us and as teachers, and now they're teaching more kids. And so, you know, it's just, it's amazing after 25 years what has happened in this country because of education reform. Not always perfect, sometimes a little messy, always, though, willing to get back on its feet and fix it and make it right. And that is, in fact, the difference. At the end of the day, no charter school in this country exists unless it performs. They get shut down. Parents make different choices. But success breeds success. And that's what we're getting to now, is that the next 25 years, in my mind, is going to happen two ways. One is that these schools are not going to just be individual laboratories, but they're going to be connected laboratories for the innovations that oftentimes have a harder time taking place and growing within a traditional system. Again, the incentives are not there for traditional systems to innovate until they need to, because risk is not usually rewarded, until which time it can be done with the lowest amount of risk. So we really look forward to being a part of the time at your gala and your conference to talk not just about U.S. either, by the way, to delve into the hemisphere and to talk about globally what is taking place, because the rest of the world is following the U.S. when it comes to education reform. They're looking to us. And so I look forward to being there. I consider it an honor to be thought of to be in the category with the honorees you are giving awards to. But it's a life's mission, and it's a purpose, and it's a legacy. That's what we're all about, and it's what God put me on the earth to do.
Well, truer words have never been said, and it's just been remarkable. And I love the fact you talk about being, it's a revolution. We're revolutionaries. Of course, I was a huge scholar and a lover of all the American Revolution studies. And we have to remind ourselves that even our founders, it wasn't all roses when they started. In fact, they were fighting it out for decades later, as many are being reminded today as it comes back into the public eye a lot. And so those of you out there, if you're listening to this prior to October 26, come on down to Miami and join us and meet the real heroes and heroines of education, opportunity, innovation. And John, thank you again so much for being with me today on Reality Check. You all can learn more about John, Charter Schools USA, where to follow him on Twitter, at edreform.com, and of course on National Review Online. And do, in fact, check back with us for regular updates. Thank you again so much, John, and thanks to you all for listening.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced by National Review and posted on Monday at nationalreview.com. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free and make sure you don't miss any future programs. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And you can also find much more about education reform, opportunity, and innovation at the Center for Education Reform's website, edreform.com. Don't forget, tune in to Reality Check every week.